On this week's show...
I think you'll find there's going to be neo-private banks
yeah.
in pretty short order. Everyone's talking about neo-banking. Mm-hmm. I think there'll be neo-private banking. And what's going to happen there? Mm-hmm. Threshold will be brought down again.
Yeah.
And you can give the private banking experience and service, but to customers with less money.
But first, a quick word from our sponsor.
Today is VE Day. The
newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
landed. Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929... The Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to the Advice Show from CityWire, where we dig into the ideas, insights and industry shakeups driving the world of financial planning. My guest this week is Alex Cowan San Luis, the CEO of Platform One.
Good morning.
Talk to me about platform technology. Why is it so bad?
It's quite a complicated sector, right? I mean, the tough thing with technology, right, is that it's been evolving over the last 25 years in the platform sector. So just by virtue of the fact of time passing, you are going to get technology that is worse.
Yeah.
Because technology that's built 20 years ago is going to be very different to technology built today.
Yeah.
But that is something that plagues every industry.
Yeah.
Every sector, right? Aging technology and having to refactor code and build on top again and reverse engineer. Mm. And of course, the more of a legacy stack you build up.
Yeah.
The more work, the more costs, the more effort it is to make something better, which is why you get challenges in every industry, including the platform sector.
Yeah, there just doesn't seem to be, and I obviously don't work in a platform, so it's hard for me to kind of imagine what the technology looks like. But people who I speak to say there doesn't seem to be a standout solution. Another person said platforms seemed stuck together with blue tack. Why?
I'm sure some are. The honest answer. I'm sure some are.
Yeah.
I think you've got this coming to, and I think there's sometimes a misconception. There is a coming together of technology and then operational processes.
Yeah.
And it's easy at the front end when you're interacting with a platform to think it's the technology that's rubbish. Mm. And it might actually be that the process running behind that is not effective. Mm. And that just reflects through the tech. Basic front end technology, login, deposit, trade, withdraw, run report is quite simple stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure any platform particularly struggles with that. Mm. It's when you get into the weeds, the back end, right? Reconciliations and books and records and payment matching and corporate action processing and settlements and dividends and all these kind of like hardcore stuff you've got to do under the hood. Mm. That is really complicated. Why is that more complicated than, say, you know, just buying an equity? Just because there are so many unhappy pathways.
Yeah.
Right? So there's the happy pathway. This is how it's going to work in a perfect world. But there's so many edge cases.
What do you mean by edge case?
Like the way that you process a dividend, for example, and there's lots of different types and different managers and different administrators and the way that they're issued to you. And there's just lots of edge cases that you have to deal with. Corporate actions, there's so many different types of corporate actions. Some are more manual and complicated than others. And so once you really dig under the hood, it gets quite complicated.
So do you see that ever changing?
I think it is changing.
Okay, go on.
I think it is changing. I think, you know, there's a lot of talk in this industry of pointing at incumbents, quote unquote, and saying, oh, they're rubbish and the challengers are great. And, you know, you would expect someone like me to say that because we're a challenger and not an incumbent. Mm. I don't think that's entirely fair, though. I think there's some massive, large incumbents out there who've got great technology. Yeah. I'm happy to name them. I mean, people love Quilter.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I always hear that from IFAs and planning staff and support staff and paraplanners. And that's a massive beast of a company.
Mm, yeah.
And yet they've managed to deliver that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a really good thing for the sector and industry. And of course, I would argue that our technology is amazing as well. And I'm sure some of our peers in the sector have great tech too. So I don't think it's all doom and gloom. But platforms evolved, you know, in the early days outside of the likes of Transact, you know, which were like pure platform. They were distribution mechanisms for much larger businesses that had other things that they do. Yeah.
So as a challenger, you describe yourself as a challenger.
Yeah.
How do you break through? Because you've got 2 billion of assets.
3.8,
is that?
Yeah, I'm very happy to be open about that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, great. How do challengers break out from the bigger platforms?
Yeah, hard grind, Vicky. there's no other like good answer to that. Challenges break out by ultimately offering a solution that the client thinks is better, right? That it provides a better solution to both the IFA or whichever particular intermediary you're providing the solution to.
Sorry, are you talking about client or advisor?
And retail client, both, okay. Right? Yeah. So it's got to be good for both. Yeah. You know, for example, if you look at us, and I always like to describe it this way, if you imagine a bell curve of average client pot size, right? Most platforms have been built over the last 20 years to service the middle of that bell curve, right? What you might deem as mass affluent, more or less. A couple of people with pensions, ISAs, kids' ISAs, etc. What the advisor wrap platforms haven't been particularly good at serving over the last 25 years is both ends of that spectrum. Now, there are some out there that do. So we're talking low pot size customers. Mm-hmm. And this comes into advice gap and consumer duty and, you know, inheriting smaller customers through acquisition and M&A and consolidation, all that good stuff. How do you deal with them in a sort of cost-effective way, in a way that still remunerates the intermediary that's looking after them? And at the other end of the spectrum, you've got those slightly higher net worth customers, but they're not high net worth enough for private banking solutions.
Yeah.
Because the threshold to be a private banking customer has moved to the right. Yeah. I think like most of the major private banks, I think, need like 5 million to be a private banking customer.
Yeah.
But if you've got 3 million, you're still a very wealthy individual, but your requirements are different to someone with 300K.
So are these people who private banks are getting sort of shedding, are they trickling down to more sort of traditional platforms?
I think you'll find there's going to be neo-private banks in pretty short order. Everyone's talking about neo-banking. Mm-hmm. I think there'll be neo-private banking. And what's going to happen there? Mm-hmm. Threshold will be brought down again.
Yeah.
And you can give the private banking experience and service, but to customers with less money. But that's a little valley there where you can go to an IFA and IFAs can look after you effectively, of course, if you've got £2, £3, £4 million of assets to look after. But your needs are more complex. Mm. Tax planning, estate planning, more esoteric asset classes you want to invest into. Mm. A lot of the platforms can't support that.
Okay. Can you?
And that's the problem. Yes, we can. So we service the entire bell curve and we can help intermediaries look after very, very small pot size customers, the obvious traditional mass affluent, mm-hmm. and then, of course, the high net worth as well. And that comes into things like having more complex tax wrappers, like trust structures, philanthropic trusts, corporates, charities, director SaaS schemes, being able to support all of that. And also the asset class as well though, Vicky. So something like, you know, venture capital trusts and you know, everyone's exploring private markets at the moment, or business relief, which becomes more topical with tax changes.
So talk to me a little bit about Platform One. How did it come about? Just give me a quick rundown of how you built that technology and the process there.
Yeah, well, a buddy and I called Dave, we went to Imperial together and we both went off and did our own things in the world and then came back with a couple of others. And knew we wanted to sort of do our own thing, didn't quite know what. They'd come from financial services background, I'd gone into sort of technology and cybersecurity. And we came together, and long story short, I won't bore you with now, but we discovered these things called IFAs. And we'd never, ever heard of an IFA before. Yeah. Which is wild, by the way. I can get on a high horse about financial education in this country. But we went on this little road show. We went around the country meeting IFAs all over the place, from two people shops to much larger firms. And they all grumbled about the same thing. Guess what? Platform, platform, platform. Lack of service, not plugging into their ecosystem, not being configurable enough, not being able to do what they want, etc., etc. Honestly, in the naivety of youth, we went, let's build it.
Yeah.
Let's try and build a platform. I mean, it's probably something that a bit older now, you'd go, oh, crikey, why do I want to do that? But, you know, in our 20s, we said, yeah, let's try this. So we started the technology. And we were a technology company first.
Yeah.
You know, not regulated, no permissions or anything like that, just pure technology. And then there was a pre-existing Platform One, so another company that was founded by a couple of ex-Accentric guys.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd been around the Accentric days, that's the modern day M&G wealth platform. And they'd been going for some time when we met them, and we saw an opportunity to take them over and therefore get the necessary permissions. And so we did exactly that. They were a very, very small entity at the time. They had 160 million of assets, headcount of 10 people. Mm. And so we thought, okay, great.
Yeah. And so today, how many people work at?
Like 61.
61 people. How many in operations? Do you have your own tech as well, don't you?
Yes, all tech is in-house, our IP. I mean, depending on how you define operations, you know, it's probably going on to sort of 65-70% of the entire company.
Right, okay. How much of it is automated? Like, talk to me a little
bit
about it.
Quite a bit. Not enough.
Yeah,
right? Okay. Well, for me anyway, I'd like to see some more automation. I've got lists as long as my arm of things I want to automate. But it kind of goes back to what I was saying before. Once you get into the weeds, it becomes really difficult automating all the edge cases. Mm-hmm. But it's highly automated, which is why we can service almost 3.8 billion with only 61 people, all in-house, all our own technology. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of our peers have many more staff than that.
Yes.
But not too dissimilar asset sizes in the grand scheme of things. And, you know, we're pretty confident that we can scale this. I mean, we could probably scale this 2 to 3x on the existing employee base.
So talk to me about the other people of a similar size. What do you think is going on there? Why do they have so many people in operations, do you think?
Ops is hard. Ops is really, really hard. And I get it, by the way. I'm not pointing the finger. You know, your first reaction is more bums on seats. Right, we need people in. We need people to come and handle this. It's a slippery slope, though. Yeah. Because you keep doing it and you invest more, and then your capital gets allocated to that rather than investing in your technology. Yeah. And it's just this snowball effect. And next thing you know, you end up with this huge back office of people, which is lovely, but you know it means that you lose sight of what you're trying to achieve with the tech.
Yes, yes.
So you've got to be quite ruthless with yourself, not with people, but with yourself, and say, okay, no, I'm actually going to take a little bit of pain for 3 months or 6 months and ensure that the technology is being improved for scale in the long term, yeah, rather than just throwing people at the problem day one.
How long did it take to build Platform One? When did you start?
It's still building, Vicky.
Still building.
Sorry, But when did you start it, and how did you, like, talk to me about time?
Yeah, it's hard to do sort of start and end time, but in terms of the actual initial technology build, I mean, call it 18 months.
18 months.
12 to 18 months to get the sort of semblance of a platform in terms of that underlying back office stuff I was talking about. Yeah. And then, of course, from there, it's evolved and been layered on and new things have been added and so on and so on.
Who are your backers?
We don't have any institutional backers. We've got no venture capital, no private equity. Yeah. In the early days, a bit like Dave did over at Nucleus, we had some clients invest in the business, which was great because, you know, bluntly, no one wants to be the first client on a new client money platform, a new custodial platform, or the second or the third. So that's the real grind at the beginning. And then angel investors.
Okay, gotcha. So would you take a private equity, an investment from private equity?
Well, that's one of those questions where whatever I say, I'm going to be wrong, aren't I, in 12 months' time. If I say no, and then there's going to be a press release in a month's time saying I've taken P money. I'm not interested in that right now.
Okay.
I might explore it in the future on behalf of shareholders, but it's not something that we're interested in.
Okay, talk to me quickly about your fees, and do you take a margin on client cash?
Yeah, so fees. So we have three distinct propositions at Platform One. We've got an advisor wrap platform. Mm-hmm. Starts at 20 basis points and tiers down according to account size. Mm-hmm. We've got the Model B thing, yep, and that basically starts at 10 bips and tiers down, mm-hmm, but it depends heavily on the scope of the Model B. And then we have what we call API SIP. It's like a plug-and-play pension that we do for trading platforms, mm-hmm, like Freetrade. Freetrade's a client of ours. Yep. And so if you open a pension on the Freetrade app today, that's us under the hood. And that tends to be more license fees to the intermediary.
Mm, yeah.
Or minimums linked to fixed costs per scheme and things like that. Mm. In terms of your question about client money interest, yeah, we're pretty open about it. We do take a margin on client money cash. I know some people do, some people don't.
How much do you take?
We've got about a 60-40 split in favour of the client. And we will improve that for the client and reduce that for us in time as well. And we have done so over the last couple of years.
Okay. Talk to me about, what was it, December? In December, Platform One revealed that the deal with Attivo, $1 billion in assets, moved from its former custodian, Titan, to Platform One.
Correct.
Talk to me. So there was this whole thing about $1 billion moved in a week. Talk to me about what happened in that week. Like, what exactly happened? Did you get client consent, for example?
Yeah, of course. There was a three-month project running up to that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Of client consent and all of the advice process that has to happen. Of course, that sits with the advisory firm. And lots of workshopping about making sure that it's as efficient as possible. Because the key with migrations is the preparation work, which I know sounds very obvious. But you want the actual migration itself, i.e., asset on this place appears on asset over here, to happen as quickly as possible for the underlying client, mm-hmm, right? So they're not they don't have a moratorium on trading for too long, that they can do things, they can have withdrawals and all the kind of good stuff that they need. So preparing for that is critical. So in that week, that is the migration. That is, we have re-registered all the assets, the cash, et cetera, from here to here.
Yeah. So
which is no mean feat, because that can be really painful, that process. As we all know in the sector, I mean, that's no secret, right? Transfers are difficult.
So are you, so is Platform One some sort of knight in shining armour then for these clients?
I'll say that.
What's the clients get out of it? What differences are they seeing?
Yeah, so I think there's a few factors, right? Cost is obviously one, price, right? So, you know, the whole idea of a lot of this is that consumers end up paying less. So that's one big one. The other one is functionality, though. Mm-hmm. Like, what more can I do? And it comes back to that bell curve again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got clients at both ends of the spectrum that have needs and requirements. And if they can't get that on their current platform provider, or at least in an easy way, mm-hmm. clearly there's a benefit to them moving. I mean, for example, being able to buy a panel of VCTs that maybe you can't do on your current platform. Mm-hmm. Maybe you want to buy a business relief product. Maybe you want to, you know, open a discretionary trust.
Yeah.
Stuff like that you can't do where you are. So there's real benefits there.
So the clients are delighted, are they?
Well, I haven't heard anything, which is good news, right?
That's
so if,
good
I haven't,
news, yeah.
if I haven't heard something, I'm assuming it's positive.
Come here to me. How much does that stretch your operations to have a billion come onto the platform?
Yeah, well, not every billion is equal. And what I mean by that is the complexity of the billion and how it's serviced. You would think I would say this, but honestly, it's a massive hat off to the IFA firm, because how effectively you can manage that is also linked to them, right? And how they manage their clients, how they interact with platform. And, you know, in this particular case, and I hope they don't mind me saying this, but Ativo have got an excellent platform servicing team.
Okay.
They're incredibly knowledgeable about platform, not just advice and planning. And that really, really helps, because it just means that the relationship, the conduit, the way that we talk to each other is just more seamless, it's faster, more effective. But no, it didn't really stretch us, which was the good news. Again, because a lot of it's automated, it's straight through processing.
Yeah, okay, got you. Right, let's talk about consolidators, advice businesses, building an in-house platform. I think there was a report by Heather Hopkins last week which kind of indicated that maybe interest is waning in building in-house platforms. What do you think?
I don't think interest is waning, actually. I did see that report. I think it depends who you speak to in the sector. The Model B proposition has evolved massively over the last 5 years. And I think there's been a lot of learnings about how, you know, what does good look like in terms of Model B deployment, and which kind of firms should be entertaining Model B and which kind of firms should not be.
So who shouldn't be?
Smaller firms. I mean,
I
don't think it's a proposition that should be taken on lightly. You are becoming the platform service provider in the eyes of the FCA.
Yeah.
You have responsibilities, governance oversight responsibilities there. Mm-hmm. And you have a responsibility to have knowledge about platform. And that's tough. I mean, you know, platforms are complicated beasts. Mm-hmm. So I think you need a certain scale and size to be able to warrant the investment into making that work.
Okay, so in terms of who should, right, say for example you have an advice business, they build an in-house platform, how do you get the advisors within that business to move platform?
It's going to be a boring answer for you, Vicky, by making it a better solution.
Yeah, but,
Because honestly, that's it. I mean, I know there's this sort of, you know, chatter in the industry about, you know, stick or carrot or anything. I don't think you should have either stick or carrot. I mean, it just should simply be a better solution for the advisors. And if you haven't selected a provider that gives you a platform that is better than the panel you currently have, then frankly, you've chosen the wrong provider, right? You've just got a poor Model B solution.
Mm. How are firms handling that? So you do hear about, let's say, for example, people who build in-house platforms, and then the advisors won't use it. What is happening? How do you think those advice firms are handling that? Is there someone, for example, coming down to an advisor's desk and going, here, move your assets or I'll sack you?
Well, I hope not. I hope that's not going. I haven't seen anything like that, for sure. Which is why you get IFAs that don't move their assets to the in-house platform, because I don't think anyone is actually doing that. Mm. I think they try and make it as attractive as possible in terms of, you know, straight through processing, nice technology, the investment proposition is streamlined, access to more functionality, blah, blah. I mean, you know, I could go on with a sort of litany of pluses, but that's what it's all about. And you are going to get some IFAs who say, thank you, but no thank you.
Okay.
Right? I mean, that's going to happen. And if they are very happy and comfortable with their current platform provider or from the panel, then that's on them. It's in the eye. They're independent.
Why do you think Ativo picked Platform One over other providers in the industry?
Three main things. They really liked our technology. Mm-hmm. They thought it was, you know, super intuitive and would bring something useful to them and their clients. The speed of execution was a big one as well. How fast can we actually get this deployed, implemented, migrated, hence the week that we spoke about. You know, doing a full 3-month project run to migration for $1 billion is no small feat, and doing it in that time frame was really attractive to them. And I think the third one is, again, our functionality, our ability to serve the bell curve.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about so $1 billion has moved. How much more is there to move?
I'm afraid that would be on them. Generally, because that is on them. Uh-huh. That's up. We're not in the background with a carrot stick either. So that is down to the firm how much they move and when they move it, if they do.
Okay. So sorry, I'm not trying to trick you, but I genuinely don't know the answer to this. But Ativo, what way does it work? They're independent. They have advisors working within that business, so they can choose their. Just to clarify, they can choose their own platform. So I assume that the $1 billion that has moved over to Platform One, it's because the advisors liked it. They like the platform.
They do. Yeah, we've had
cheaper.
No noise either, so which is another good sign. We haven't haven't had a peep, which is really lovely.
Yeah. Talk to me about that. So, say for example, you sign a deal with Ativo, platform gets built, then the advisors how does it work? Like, do they say to the CEO, yeah, we want to move to this platform, and then do they migrate straight away?
It's a bit more structured than that. I think they, Ativo or otherwise, any IFA firm that's doing an in-house platform, they go out with a proposition to their advisors, right, and say, look, this is what we've launched. They educate them, they talk about the benefits, and then they start identifying advisors and books of clients that they think might be appropriate to move.
Yeah.
And some of those might not be appropriate to move.
Yeah.
So it's very much down to them and the advice process that they run.
Yeah. It's bulk migration, so you do it in kind of stages.
There'll be mixes, right?
Yeah.
The industry would love to get to a nirvana of, lift and shift bulk migrations overnight for the consumer, right? It depends on so many factors. The seeding scheme you're bringing it from, the wrappers, the asset classes they're invested in, and actually, whether they sit on good technology or bad technology, when you asked me at the beginning, getting stuff off some of the older life companies or from banks, for example, that's going to be trickier because the technology is way older.
Okay, so speaking of technology, so people talk about, you hear about AI, we hear about AI all the time, how it's going to change everything. What are platforms doing?
It's a great question. I actually chair the AI working group for the Platform Association, so I'm quite involved in this. Mm-hmm. And I won't speak out of turn about what happens within the Platform Association as a trade body. But there's a lot of, I think the simplest way of discussing it is there is a enormous amount of excitement and belief in the possibility of it. Mm-hmm. And then there's this huge valley, or gap, canyon, whatever you want to call it, to actual implementation. And rolling AI out. And I think the reason for that gap is driven by many different factors. Mm. But one of them is trepidation from a regulatory perspective, not from a technology perspective. Yeah. Getting nervous, saying, crikey, if I implement an AI solution and it screws up and something goes wrong for a client and the regulator comes in, enforcement, supervisory, what do I do? Like, where's the governance framework? Yeah. Where's the structure? Because we've got nothing to hang our hat on, like you're doing CAS, prudential, risk, et cetera, et cetera. So I think one of the first steps for the sector is kind of getting that language, that shared understanding between the regulator, Treasury, and by regulator I don't just mean FCA but TPR, and say, okay, how do we speak about this together when something goes wrong?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
It's easy when it goes right, better outcomes for customers, but obviously stuff will go wrong because stuff goes wrong in life, and I think that is what's holding people back.
So what is the answer? Is the answer having a platform with a back office attached to it?
Maybe. Again, it depends on your client base and your client profile. I don't think arbitrarily saying, I'll come and use ours versus the one that you're embedded with today is necessarily the answer. But at the same time, it might be. Yeah. People like optionality, right? So they might like their current back office systems. And a lot of the back office system providers in the market right now are investing quite heavily in AI as well.
Yeah. So IntelliFlow.
They've launched a bunch of stuff, right, over the last year. That's one example.
Yeah.
I think there's a general wider question about AI, about, you know, where's the value capture going to be? Right? Is it going to be the existing, you know, SaaS technology companies, providers, enterprise solutions providers? Is it going to be the model providers under the hood who actually get all of the value capture? Or is it going to be the consumer? Yeah. And I think you're finding a lot of private equity, a lot of institutional capital is going, which way, where is this going? Mm. And you know, probably the worst case scenario for them is the consumer capturing all the value, because then there's nothing to invest in. Yeah. But in the middle ground, in principle, existing technology platforms should have the leverage to deploy AI solutions faster than AI native companies, in principle. AI native companies are very good at building quite rapidly at the beginning, but then you've got to start getting into scale and infrastructure and enterprise style solutions, which is all about execution and delivery. It's not about the technology. Yeah. So you can have fantastic AI technology. If you can't actually deliver it at an enterprise level, then you're struggling.
Are you getting the sense that some, like say for example, Stephen Levin talked about his project, Quilter's project, with that it's running with FNZ to build a back office system?
That's a great example.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a great example of that, right? FNZ, huge existing provider. Yeah. Quilter, big existing company. And they have the scale and leverage and execution capabilities to be able to go, actually, you know, we can deploy some AI tooling through this.
Yeah. So will other platforms be left behind then? Like, Quilter?
I think AI is one of the, what, in terms of back office or AI?
Back office and AI.
I think what you're going to find is that a lot of, over the next 5-10 years, a lot of definitions are going to change. Like, what even is a back office once you've got AI? Is it even the same thing? So, you know, you're building out a back office in today's world and perspective, but in 5 years, it might be completely torn up as to what that means. So I think we have to be careful talking about, oh, you know, should you implement a back office or not, and focus more on what does the client need and then what technology can deliver that. Mm. And you know, in answer to the getting left behind question, I think this is going to be like any tech shift. You know, you get some who absolutely rocket off the back of it, some who die off the back of it, and most people in the middle will jump on the train at some point. You know, that's kind of what happened with the internet, right? There were all the naysayers about the internet. Oh, the World Wide Web won't last. I mean, there's so many famous examples of that. And of course, there was a dot-com bubble as well. You know, there's all kinds of stuff. But here we are today, and the world runs off it.
Alex, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you. Been a pleasure as always, Vicky.
But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crowned queen waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.